Well, I really did like those songs as well. What is fertility worship? Turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. I think that this title, at least, well, I'll just say it this way. I'm not much of a writer, but I do write my sermon notes, and sometimes it seems as if they have a life of their own, and they do things that you didn't really intend for them to do, and when you try to make them do something else, you end up with this conglomeration of stuff that just won't work. That is simply to say that fertility worship may not be exactly what we talk about. If I were to give it a second title, I might give it sexuality worship. And then maybe this afternoon with the child sacrifice, some of the fertility parts might come into that. So bear with me on that. 1 Kings chapter 18. I'm just going to break into the middle of a well-known story. Chapter 18, verse 25. And Elijah said unto the prophets of Baal, choose you one bullock for yourselves and dress it first, for ye are many. Call on your gods, call on the name of your gods, but put no fire under. So we know this is the contest between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Who's going to rain fire down on the sacrifice? So they took the bullock, which was given them, they dressed it, and called on the name of Baal from morning even until noon, saying, O Baal, hear us. But there was no voice, nor any that answered, and they leapt upon the altar which was made. And it came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is talking, or he is pursuing, or he is in a journey, or peradventure he sleepeth and must be awaked. And they cried aloud, cut themselves after their manner with knives and lancets, till the blood gushed out upon them. It came to pass, when midday was past, and they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, that there was neither voice, nor any to answer, nor any that regarded. Well, what does that have to do with fertility worship? We'll get to that in just a little bit. This message, I broke it down into two main questions again. First, just a brief overview of what is neo-paganism in the LGBTQ+ movement. And second, what are Bible standards for men, women, and helping our children embrace the God-given roles? Neo-pagan fertility worship in the alphabet spaghetti that we now know as LGBTQ+. When you do any kind of study on ancient fertility rituals, one soon concludes that maybe we are navigating territory that Paul the Apostle would say is even ashamed to speak of. And so maybe we shouldn't do it at all. Maybe we should just not talk about the terrible things that happen in the ancient cults and fertility rituals. I wonder about that when we talk about the modern neo-pagan worship of sexual identity. But I trust God's voice in my brothers, and you all asked me to talk about it, so listen at your own risk. The ancient rituals of sexual worship, if you will, the rites of idolatry involved, they saw the body, the physical body of a person, as a spiritual medium through which they could access their God or to mirror the divine role or reality that they believed. It's a condensed statement to say that they believed they could act out things in their bodies to please their gods, to gain access to deeper spirituality. And so 1 Kings 18, I do not know for sure that this would have involved some kind of sexual act. It doesn't seem like it necessarily needs to, but one of the elements of this particular worship of Baal was bodily mutilation. And so somehow in their minds, they thought that if they would cut themselves until the blood gushed out upon them, that this would in some way gain them access to the realm of Baal. How odd is that to our modern ears? Any study of this, you will find other gods that have been worshipped throughout history. The Bible doesn't mention some of these specifically. I just wanted this particular passage because it very graphically talks about, like it explicitly mentions that they cut themselves. There are other idols that are mentioned that you don't, that doesn't say what they did. And so you just kind of assume that based on the other historical evidence that this would have been involved. And so what would have those things been? Well, all kinds of sexual acts, deviations of the sex act. There were people who were castrated in the worship of ancient gods. There were priests involved in cross-dressing and things like that. And so we get a glimpse into the ancient idol worship. And we fast forward to today, and what is the, if that conceptualization was that the body was the way to gain access to the spiritual realities as they saw them, what is the body viewed as now? Well, I would submit to you that the body is viewed as a medium through which our identity is expressed. That's the modern, what would you call it? The word just left me. Whatever, way of thinking. And so what do people do? Well, there's a belief in the sovereign self, that myself, I get to decide all kinds of things for myself. We live in a society that believes in fluid gender and self-defining. Cross-dressing is definitely one of them. And then every single letter of that list that we see everywhere, it seems like, we have all of those deviations in the acronym that we see. And it's all because people want to identify themselves as something, usually in an attempt to be unique. And there is no limit to uniqueness. Every one of us here this morning could find something that would set us apart from the rest. And, well, that gets boring after a while, and you can't claim victimhood because you like tomatoes and the other guy doesn't like tomatoes, right? You can't. That's not a victim. But you can somehow formulate the idea that I'm a man trapped inside a woman's body as being a victim of circumstances outside of your control, and therefore you should be pitied, therefore you should be given all kinds of rights outside of the normal society. That's the prevailing narrative. How we got here is way beyond the scope of this message. I don't think I could unpack the history of this path in a sufficient manner in the time given. It is a generalization, therefore, a huge generalization to say that I believe that many of these ideas of fluid gender and self-definition and identity politics is rooted in the feminist movement. And the feminist movement was the beginning of this when it began to say that women's identities are formed by culture and society. And so If you accept that as true, then why not keep taking the logic a little bit farther and a little bit farther? And I think that's where we've gotten to, where everything in life is artificially constructed by culture and society. And that is a statement of truth in our world that needs to be questioned. Is that true, that everything about you and me is defined by the society in which I live? I say, Christian answer is no. why should we say that it's no? Hopefully we can cover at least some of that this morning. The only element of truth in the statement that society forms men and women, the only element of truth in that is that some roles are socially and culturally constructed. Let me illustrate that for you. In this room today, I'm among people that I believe tend to see cooking and sewing as feminine activities. I believe this is truly cultural. If one of you boys would say, I really enjoy sewing my sister's dresses, we would say, really? Like, I mean, that's a culturally jarring thing to say. However, can we say that sewing is not a masculine thing to do? No, you cannot say that. For generations, for years, and even in other cultures today, men make their livings sewing clothes. So we just fold up and say, well, then everything is culturally constructed. Well, that's way too simplistic, but that's kind of what has happened. And so but we need to remember, just to make sure I'm clear on this, to have a culture that says sewing is a typically feminine thing to do is not necessarily wrong. Like, that's not a wrong thing to say that this particular family, this is what the men are going to do, this is what the women are going to do. That's just the way we're going to structure our lives so that the best use of our time can be made. And so it's wrong to assume that a man who enjoys cooking or sewing is somehow less than masculine, or that a girl who enjoys, say, woodworking beyond getting out the hot glue gun and making a craft is somehow too masculine or something like that. It's not really helpful to think about it that way. And so the reason we're even exploring this rabbit trail is to establish that, yes, there are certain roles and certain jobs that do get defined. I'm not going to say artificially. They just get defined by what makes the most sense in the world you've set up for yourselves. And in our plain Anabaptist society culture, it seems that we've accepted that, and it's usually okay. So the questions. I don't think it would be helpful to delve too deeply into all the grotesqueries of the homosexual, the queer, transgender activism, or the agenda. But if you're an adult with any awareness at all of the mainstream media, then you know most of what you need to know. It's pretty clear to me that there is an agenda. Who thought the agenda up? I don't know that I can say with any kind of certainty, but there certainly seems to be an agenda to make the public desensitized to these issues by repeated reporting in the mainstream media. It's also clearly to make the public believe that it's more ubiquitous than it actually is by repeated reporting. When you look at numbers of how many people actually are transgender, the percent is minuscule compared to the majority. But because they get the most attention, we are led to believe that everybody is probably trapped in a body that doesn't belong to them. At least that's how it starts to seem. The agenda also seems to make the mainstream population sympathetic to these people by framing them as victims of a system rather than people who are making moral choices. I think that's obvious and okay to say, even though it's not, doesn't sound kind. This campaign that I just described to you has been highly effective with homosexuality, and it's the same playbook that's being used for the sexual deviances that are being pushed today. The truly frightening thing in our world is that there are misguided legislations that exist in parts of the world that any person, parent, who disagrees with a child who says they want to be a boy/girl as opposed to what their body says they are, is seen as abuse, and the child can be taken from the parents. They can also receive gender-affirming care without the parents' consent or knowledge. This is horrifying when you think about it. I don't know where Pennsylvania is, but that's not happening in the South at this point, as far as I know. It's more of the what we would consider liberal politics and so on. So what's the counter to this? Do we just shake our heads and say, what in the world is happening? Or is there a way to actually live wisely and to push back on this? And I think, well, it seems to me that the only truly meaningful way to counter falsehood is to soak in the truth. And to counter the attacks of evil is to ground ourselves in love and righteousness. So how can we strengthen the godly roles of men and women? Well, I'm assuming that I'm talking to Bible scholars here this morning, and so I'm going to pull principles out of Genesis 2 and Ephesians 5 and give you three roles, godly roles for men. They're not specifically stated in the Bible. I'm just giving you them as kind of a overview or condensation of those things. I believe the Bible teaches us that men are created in the image of God to reflect God's strength, leadership, provision, and authority. In marriage, men are called to reflect the selfless love that Christ displayed to the church. And in men, our power expressions, if you can bear with that kind of psychobabble, are building, defending, and dying. That's the way manly, masculine power is expressed. And for women, I believe the Bible teaches us that they are created in the image of God to reflect his beauty, nurture, and relational wisdom. In marriage, women are called to reflect the respect and responsive strength that the church is called to, and the power expressions are healing, connecting, and bringing life. I think that's a biblical standard. And these virtues are what I would consider or believe to be the feminine and masculine reflections of God. And they're not limited to marriage. Ephesians 5 gives it in the context of marriage, but it's not limited to a marriage relationship. This is the calling, I believe, for all women, all men, and it's a godly calling. And it brings a harmonious balance to each other and to the world. And this, the temptation for selfish fallen humans is to say, my job of creating these aspects of God are more important and better than yours. And so therefore we're going to have a fight about this. And that's been the whole problem. That's why marriage problems exist. That's why the feminist movement exists. That's why patriarchal tyranny exists. There's all kinds of reasons that fallen humans want to build themselves up and force other people to serve them and make them feel less useful. And so Christians see these roles not as comparisons to make somebody unnecessary or worse or better or whatever. It's to make sure that we see these as equally important and different. And for those of you who think that maybe I stereotype men and women a little too much, because maybe you're a man who loves beauty and nurture and you love relationships, well, I would submit to you that these categories are the rule, and that any exception to that actually proves the rule. If that makes sense. So, I'm not denying that some men do seem to have a more feminine side to them, or that some women have a more masculine side to them. I'm not denying any of that. I'm saying, in general, this is the calling of men and women. And to embrace that is not wrong. It will actually be helpful in the long term. I believe that we can best strengthen these roles in our lives and in our children by embracing with trust the goodness of God's design. If we are constantly fighting, if we're constantly resentful of the way we're made and the role we're called to fill, why would we ever expect our children to think differently without some outside intervention outside of ourselves? Of course they're going to think that it's a mistake to be made a man if the man in their life has never accepted the fact that he's a man. Maybe he's never gone and gotten surgery to change himself, but if he's constantly beefing about how, you know, he just, everybody's leaning on him and he just doesn't want to take responsibility and he shirks his responsibility and he forces his wife to do things that he should be doing for the family, well, why would a boy want to be a boy? and vice versa. That seems extreme, but I think that's probably some of what's happening in our society. And so we trust God's plan, and we live in the fullness that it brings to our lives. How can we strengthen our appreciation for godly marriages? Well, I think, first of all, we need to root ourselves in the definition that the Bible gives of marriage. I believe that marriage, as defined by the Bible, is a covenant relationship between one man and one woman for life. And that's laid down in Genesis chapter 1, verses 17 to 28. We haven't read a lot of Bible verses. Maybe we should just go to those because we believe that the creation gives us a foundation from which we can build. And it's not bad to keep refreshing our minds on this. But Genesis 1, 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. And God blessed them. I'm sorry, I said 17, didn't I? I don't know why I said 17. 26 is what I wanted. Anyway, I'm all confused now. Let us make man in our image after our likeness. And so that's what he did. And then in verse 28, God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And then we go to chapter 2, verse 24. He says, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Jesus confirms that in Matthew chapter 19, verses 4 through 6. Just go ahead and read those verses as well. The people come to him and they say, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, I'm in Matthew 19, verse 4, have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. So Jesus confirms the pattern in Genesis. Paul assumes that pattern in Ephesians 5. We referenced that earlier, but when he talks about a man and a woman and the roles that they play, there's just the assumption. He does not go into any sort of defense of it. He just assumes that this is what's going to happen. And then we have the culmination of earthly marriage in Revelation at the marriage supper of the Lamb. And so the Bible is actually a marriage story all the way through. And Genesis through Revelation assumes a man-woman marriage. So that's to root us in the biblical definition of marriage. Anything outside of that, anytime we believe that a different pattern would suit us better, will lead to less than fulfillment. It will lead to hardship and problems. Sin always does. As Christians, the more we mature, we need to understand that nobody gets away with it, ever. It may look like it for a time, but the only promise that we have for the pleasures of sin is in Hebrews, and it's for a season. How long that season is, none of us get to choose, but it's only for a time. The only way that we get to have eternal life and happiness and fulfillment is to follow God's ways. And then we're promised that eternal life and life that is more abundant according to the scriptures. My apologies, this is a little confusing here. And so the best way we can strengthen this trust in God with our marriage arrangement is to take deliberate steps in all areas of life to trust God. And so as Christians, we accept God's ways, and we also accept our bodies as the way God made them. And so we also accept many other things, the path, the calling in life. We don't resent God and his leading in our life. And this is all in the answer to the question of how can we strengthen our standing on truth. I think we need a revival of radical obedience and self-denial in all areas of life. I know I certainly could use it, and I think that seems to be a general feel for all of us. When was the last time you just turned everything over to God and said, it's all yours, you can do with it what you want. I'm just going to be a steward as wise as I know how to be. I used to pray that a lot more than I do now, just to confess that to you. How can we protect our children from the deception of the world? Well, soak in the truth. Again, coming back to what we said earlier, God created, and it's very good. And in our exemplifying of a love for truth, we understand that truth sets us free. Truth demands a stance of humility and acceptance of difficult things. Truth is simple, but it's not easy. And that's one of the reasons that human beings lie. We lie because it looks like the easy way out, but it's never simple. It's very complex. Truth demands that we change our behavior. It demands that we change our way of thinking. The biblical term for this is repentance. That's what truth demands. And so it's a hard thing to accept truth. But if we want to protect our children from deception, then we must walk in the truth ourselves as fathers and mothers and leaders. It seems to me that this is one of the only ways that we can defend against deception, is when we have exemplified a willingness to adjust our life and mindset to the truth when it is even counter to what we prefer. How can we guide those who are trapped in this deception to freedom in Christ? This was one of the questions that the committee gave to me. And I will be honest with you, I don't know. I have not spoken to a person ever who was seeking to be free from this type of lifestyle, whether it's homosexuality or transgenderism or whatever it is. I have spoken with young men who have struggled with things like pornography, which is a forerunner to a lot of issues. But how do we get out of those things? What principles can guide us? And so I'm only going to offer principles. I don't have experience to draw from, but to wrap up here, I've got a couple of principles, and I'm going to spend a little more time on each one of them than perhaps I did on the other message. But I believe that if a person is truly seeking, there's a couple of things to guide us. First of all, we don't hate anyone. Christians need to be the ones leading the way in seeing the image of God in every person we encounter. This is extremely difficult to do because I am around people sometimes that, well, if that's the image of God, then he's a lot uglier than what I thought he was, right? Like, that's the way your mind works. And so they make you uncomfortable. They smell bad. They do things that are exceedingly harmful. They waste their money on things that just destroy their lives. They live immoral lives and then wonder why they can never succeed. And it's very easy to look at them and say, you're a loser. Like, that's the easiest thing for me to do. And it's difficult to see them as someone that God sent his son to die for. And for Christians, this is a calling that we have. And so we're called to this, and that's why we don't kill people or reject them based on anything they are created with. Now, I want you to stick with me on this point. Skin color, gender, age, there is no reason to discriminate against anybody. It is unfortunate that Christians over the years have been known, when I say Christians, that's so-called Christians, have been known to be some of the most racist and some of the most misogynistic and to discriminate against people more than anyone else. And I just confess to you how easy that is. But biblically, we are not allowed to do that. However, we are called to reject people who make certain choices. And this sounds intolerant, right? But it's true. 2 John verses 9 through 11 tell us that there are some people that we reject. But it's not based on anything that they're created with. 2 John verse 9, whosoever transgresseth and transgresseth and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ hath not God. He that abideth in the doctrine of Christ, he hath both the Father and the Son. If there come any unto you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed, for he that biddeth him Godspeed is partaker of his evil deeds. That's pretty clear. Titus is another passage where it says, a man that's a heretic after two or three times of rebuke, you reject him. So, Christians are called to reject. But here's the odd thing. It is far easier for me to reject the homeless man that comes asking for help than it is the Mormon that comes to witness to me. It is far easier to reject the one and not the other. And that is exactly what the Bible tells us not to do. Jesus, on the other hand, says, when I was homeless, you never came and helped me. When I was in prison, you never came and visited me. And we're like, when did we see that? He's like, it's all around you. And so, as Christians, we don't hate people, but we cannot be partakers in their sin. And if I can quote an author here, he says that we must love the sinner and hate the sin. And we think that's hard to do, but he made the case that we do that every day with ourselves. And that's solid. I can't find anything to get under that and overturn that. Every single day, I am easier on myself than I tend to be with anybody else because I know what my intentions are. And so the goal is to see everybody else as having the intentions to do the good that I intend to do and to judge them on that basis. That's the goal. And somehow then we can begin to separate the love of the sinner and the hatred for the sin. The second thing, helping people. So we don't hate people. So helping someone who's trapped in this horrific deception of gender identities and so on, first of all, there's no way to help somebody that you're rejecting. I think that's just clear. We can't help them unless we're actually willing to sit down and talk about some things. Second, we must accept that there are only male and female. Isn't it appalling that in an age that is able to put a chip in your brain and you can manage a machine with your thoughts, that the same group of people, maybe not exactly the same people, but the same field of technology, will say that we don't know if the baby's a boy or a girl. We need to let them decide. How odd is that? If you can edit human DNA to give them blue eyes versus brown eyes, you certainly know that every human cell, every male human cell is XY coded and the female is XX. You know that. Why in the world would we ever find ourselves in a situation where we say that that doesn't mean anything? To argue about how one feels is a totally different subject. You may not feel like a woman or a man, but that's not the point. The point is whether or not you are one or not. And as Christians, this is where truth gets tough. But remember, truth brings freedom. And if a person will not accept this as basic truth, there will be no freedom from deception. I think we may as well just stop the conversation at that point. In my opinion, I've never sat with people like this, again, full disclosure, but it seems to me that if you get to a point in a conversation with somebody and you ask this question, do you believe that there's only male and female, and they say no, then it's like, well, where do you go from there? You have to accept reality, which takes me to another point. when our minds and feelings conflict with what is reality, it is not reality that needs to be adjusted. Minds and feelings are like a dashboard light. None of us, when our low fuel light comes on, decides to replace the engine. Like, it's just not the go-to. And so if someone is feeling less than a man and they're in a man's body, I don't even like to use those expressions. It just sounds like you're bowing to the prevailing narrative and it makes me cross. But you're not trapped in a man's body. It's just not even true. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. We don't just do an engine replacement whenever the fuel light comes on. Romans 12. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Here is a biblical principle that tells us that reality is what it is, and if we don't want to accept reality, the problem isn't with reality. The problem is with our minds. And this is true for emotional struggles. This is true for gender identity struggles. It's just true. It's true for someone who thinks that the only way that they can have pleasure in life is to be married. It's true for so many things that we have to accept this, that our minds are the problem, and that when we accept the truth, it will transform us, and suddenly we understand what God wants us to be and how he wants us to live in the reality that he's created us with. And so if we have these homosexual urges, or we think that we're somehow trapped in the wrong body, we may need to have a more thoughtful approach. I do not know that it's the most helpful thing to tell someone, well, you just need to stop thinking that way. I've certainly never found that to be particularly helpful when I'm feeling discouraged about something and somebody says, well, just stop. Well, that's not the most helpful thing. It's more helpful to, well, what is it exactly that has you upset at this moment? And if you can actually get the person to verbalize what it is that they're not happy about, they're already three-fourths of the way to solving the problem. And so one more thought that I think is worth thinking about on this whole issue of these urges or these identities that people say they're born with. What if I identified as a murderer? Would that be okay? We don't do this with any other sort of crazy activity that harms people. But somehow in our world, this has become acceptable, and I don't know why. Like, I don't get that, other than there's just massive deception involved. And for what, I don't know. I don't know. Well, the devil's out to kill and steal and destroy, and so I guess that's a good enough answer. But we do not do this with anything else as a society. But somehow with the core of who a person is, your actual sexuality is pretty much one of the core things about who you are. It's one of the first things you notice about a person, for instance, is whether they're male or female, and that's why it's so jarring when you don't know. It's very jarring. And there's a reason for that. It's because it's a basic way of identifying. So what are some thoughtful ways? Well, as I thought about this and listened to different people talk about it, again, no direct experience with this, but with other sorts of addictions and so on, one of the questions that I find to be very helpful is in starting a conversation is, what is it about being a man or a woman that you think is desirable? Why is that the case? So instead of just saying, stop thinking that you want to be a man or a woman as opposed to what you actually are, the to me a deeper question is, what is it that you want? There's obviously something that you're not satisfied with. What makes you think that switching gender is somehow going to help? And that may lead to a discussion. Another thing that I think should guide us as Christians, we should never assume that our native urges are the most trustworthy urges. The Bible urges us, keep using the word urge, to put off the old man. Ephesians 4:22, put off concerning the former conversation, the old man, which is corrupt according to the deceitful lust. Romans 6:6, our old man is crucified with him, that the body of sin might be destroyed, that henceforth we should not serve sin. And so Romans also tells us that we should not make provisions for the flesh. And so there's all kinds of biblical injunctions that help us understand that our urges, our thoughts, our emotions may be warning signs that we should seek God and His answers, but they are not reality. They need to be brought into line with reality. And last, helping people. If a person is on the path to freedom, we should expect some failure because, well, coming out of that kind of deception is a long journey, I would imagine. But while we expect some failure, we also expect patterns of victory and submission and accountability to God's community, which is the church. We do expect that. And if a person is truly repentant, you don't have to wonder. Do you ever think about that? I don't know why it is that sometimes we as church leaders, as dads, as moms, we sit and we wonder if our children are repentant. We wonder if that person is repentant. I think we usually know, and if they're not, we're just too scared to say that they're not. I think that's what it is. In conclusion, this I feel was rather eye-watering in its scope, and I don't know how to pull this all together, but I'm just going to recap with a couple of statements. Love the truth, trust God's design and plan, and submit in faith to obedience. It might not be popular, but it is the righteous alternative. God bless you all.